Accession number 28729, Reel 6.
Burdette, Reel 6. So, in this first period, you were starting to set ambushes, were you, to try and catch the bandits moving at night?
Yeah.
How often would you be setting these ambushes, roughly? Would it be every night, or would you have a routine?
Well, I told you, I mentioned before that we were so short of men, so we were out every night. And the only thing is, though, that they had to stop that, because we found out there wasn't sufficient men to go out patrolling in the daytime. If they had an emergency, and a second emergency had arose, they hadn't got anybody. Well, they had us, but we were trying to recover from the night before. And it does take you out of it, because you walk in, they drop you off as near as possible, but they can't drop you too close, because the sound of the lorry stopping, and then the sideboard's going down, and then the noise of us getting off, they're aware of this. Hello, they're doing something in this area. So they keep away from the area. So what's the point of having an ambush? They even tried to get us to jump off the vehicle at 15 miles an hour. And so we had training of that. And the first one we did, well, most of the blokes lost their ammunition. It bounced all over the place. One bloke bent his rifle. The other one snapped his Bren gun up across the breech. And all the rounds went, and there we were, picking these bloody rounds up on the road. And they went in the ditch and so forth. And we had to try and account for everyone, because we were not leaving for them. They'd use it against us. So we lost that. Well, it was just a waste of time, because we were making more noise jumping off than we were when it stopped. So we tried to say to them, look, keep the engine running, rev it as the same rev. The MTs boys, well, they were our blokes, they worked in the way, you see, like that. And ground the gears as if they're having trouble getting the gears. And we'd be getting off the lorry then, you see. Then we'd make our way into the jungle, through the rubber mostly, into the jungle. And sometimes that was 2 or 3 miles. Stay there all night, couldn't move until daylight. Because we didn't want so somebody else may go there the next night. Because that may be a regular route. And the root was the fact that there was a scheme where they were getting all the villagers, knocking the villagers down and putting the villagers in kampongs or controlled areas, because the communists were getting the food off them and threatening them and trying to entice them to join them. So they put them in these compounds surrounded by barbed wire, protected by the police. And they had passes to go in and out, and that would be a curfew hour, that would be back, or the whole families. And so the towns were created. So their villages were put burnt down or pulled down. So these communists had to come out in the jungle and try to get into the compound, or get near the compound. So that's where we kept finding the trails to the compounds and to the villages. And then they got wise to that, because they were losing a lot of men. Again, the firepower over... For 5 minutes, the rounds that went into that area, it was amazing.
What were you armed with during the ambushes? Did you have a rifle or a Bren gun, or did you carry both, or an Owen gun?
No, I never did carry an Owen gun. I don't know why, but mostly the rifle and the Bren gun. Even when I was an NCO, I didn't have the carbine. I thought the rifle, to me, I could use a rifle very quickly, and I said I was ambidextrous, so I could fire left or right. If I can jump a little bit, we had an immediate ambush. I'll give you an idea. We got off the lorries, and we hadn't walked 20 minutes, and it was sort of a floating air, falling down away from the road, and the track curled to the left and then to the right, and then into the jungle. There wasn't any rubber, it was just scrubland, and with a few trees. But where we went through was probably a small village that had been knocked down, and it had been overgrown. We got level with that. It was probably mid-morning, because they said that what happened, a gang had stopped a bus, got everybody out, burnt the bus, and took all their papers and some money and so forth. So they terrified 20 or 30 people. So it's a gang of five. So they knew they were walking some way, so they put their brains together, the police and our lot, and said, right, 10 to 1, they'll be coming out this way. So we went onto that track, and we met them. The signs went up, and I couldn't read the signs, because the bloke in front of me was waving his arms about, and he hadn't given me the proper sign, the ambush sign to that. So I didn't know what... So the bloke said to me, with my section, what's happening? I said, obviously they met something at the front, let's get off the track. So we got off the track and hid behind trees and bushes and so forth, and then suddenly the enemy came along. Now, two men from me was the last man. Now, the last man fires in an ambush situation, because someone's got to fire. You can't shout out fire because they'll drop. They're so quick. So my mate, who was two bullets away from me, was looking at me, and I went, and he fired at the first one. He got him, and then everybody opened up. And I fired, and the bloke, I managed to turn and run away. Now, I was on the left-hand side of the tree, so I was firing left-handed. That's all right, but the bolt's on the right, to get a secondary bolt, you see. So I fired left, like that, and I saw a piece of his shoulder blade go up in the air, with all his fabrics of his shirt and so forth, like that. Went bang at her. I tried to do the bolt again, I thought, no, change. So I changed on the other side of the tree, did the bolt action, got another one, wish we had an automatic there, and fired dead in the centre of his back. He was 20 yards away from me by then. And I heard it thump into his pack. I knew it went into his body. He still went running on. I hadn't got a vital organ. Even though half his shoulder blade was missing, he still went running on. And he do, the fear as well. But the other four had dropped down. They'd got, and I was the only one who got away. And he went into the bush, and I threw hand grenades at him and phosphorus. And the officer said to me, "Are you going to go in?" I said, "No, I'm not going to go," because he had a sawn-off shotgun. And if he, even with his last ounce of strength, our blokes have lost their lives by that. They die, but before they die, they pull the trigger, and a shotgun makes a hell of a mess of you. No good trying to go to the hospital with that lot in you. And it all happened so quickly. And it was the most successful immediate ambush in the history of the British. How it happened, so quick. And it was so successful. And it was the gang that had burnt this bus. And it was mentioned, and the officer said, if they hadn't gone out again on another patrol, we all would have been mentioned on dispatches. And that you get a laurel leaf on your medal for that, and on your ribbon. Because it happened so quick and perfect. And we didn't overexpand our bullets, our rounds, you know, we didn't fire madly. Once the target had dropped, everybody stopped. It was good, and I was proud of the lads, you know, really.
What was the kind of percentage of times that you would have a contact in comparison with times when nothing would happen?
One in 50. Again, it was show the flag, most of it. It was, to encounter them, you mentioned about the noise. I've got to go back on our first early patrols. The first early patrols, we used to go out for weeks. This is down in Sagamet, in Johor. And there was a great big string of us, nearly half a company went out. And there was banging and clanging, so we were in the jungle and cursing and swearing and banging and clanging. So we got a camp here then. So we started making a camp, and they were still coming into camp from the delay of the folks going in single file. And the charwaller come in with his big cairn, and he set up camp, and they accepted this. That's what all the other regiments used to do. And he was selling tea. Charwaller, cup of tea. And he went round in the morning, you know, and gave us all cups of tea in the morning before we went out on patrol. And I thought to myself, even to us, it was a bit stupid. Everybody knows where we are. What's the point? We could hear them, they heard us. That eventually stopped. And because the Suffolks learnt quickly about this kind of thing, and it was a bit stupid, that was.
Is there any reason you would say why the Suffolks were very good at what they did?
Well, I was going to go on to that, because I knew straight away that our NCOs were above par. They were all, well, most of them were ex-Chindits. Second World War men, regulars, signed on. They had the old Australian bush hats, and what they didn't know about the jungle. And they were our NCOs. Even a large jack had been, even privates had been a Chindits. And they spread them around in the companies. Of course, they were our leaders. They led the officers as well, advised the officers. The officers, some of them were national servicemen. And they were inexperienced the same as we were.
Is there anything you would say, though, in the sort of, like, regional characteristics of the ordinary soldiers who came from the kind of the Suffolk area? Is there anything in their kind of nature that might have made them?
Well, I thought, yeah, I agree. I thought it would be, because the Norfolk and Suffolk boys are agricultural lads, and you think them are all ER and ploughers and all that kind of thing. I mean, our regiment of marches speed the plough. You think that they're all sort of games people, you know, that, you know, but they're not. No, they're no different than we are, because they've got a sort of slow, ponderous accent. No, because a lot of our blokes were Northamptons, Essex, Beds and Hearts. They were ordinary blokes from towns and villages. I think the difference was, it was they had a comradeship throughout all the regiments, of course, but our officers and our NCOs were excellent. The 50% of the officers were keen, intelligent men. And being keen, they wanted to get the MC. They wanted to get recognition for their endeavours. And they were fit, and we were all fit. And we came, they used to listen to us. We would not go down a track a second time. If we hit this track, we'd try and walk down it for half a mile and get off and make our own track, but walk alongside that, about 200 yards away from their track, where we think the track would go. And it's usually following the terrain, you know, a river or a well-known area. But that's where the poor old devils like the Royal West Kents, they used to go down the same track. And they admitted to us. And they walked through our ambush position several times, Royal West Kents. Even the Gurkhas walked through our position. And they didn't know we were there. So that's what I think. We didn't go down the same track. We were quiet, we were diligent, we were observant. I think it's our officers doing this.
I was wondering, with this sort of the agricultural background.
I think they were probably forest-wise, where we were street-wise. We had a lot of Londoners there, and they didn't know the difference between a road, a pathway, or a highway. A tree. That's what they're the lads who couldn't pick themselves up on the ropes. They were street-wise, all right. They were cocky little devils, but they were entertainers. And we had the majority of us were country boys, and I think that was the difference. And also the fact that we had a lot of people that would talk to each other. You get the silent boys, like one of our officers, Jimmy Kelly, who had the greatest respect for what we had. He led us in most dangerous situations and got us out a lot, and we had everything confidence with him. But he was a solitary person. If we stopped to have a smoke, he wouldn't stand with us. And we thought, all right, an officer doesn't want to get too friendly because he may have to tell us to do something nasty. And we've got to obey him no matter what, in a way. But there again, he used to ask our opinion. That's what he was, an intelligent man. And we'd go anywhere with him. And I think that was the thing as well. It wasn't the Suffolks or anything like that. It was the individuals, really. If you changed the flag, it wouldn't make the slightest difference. It was the group of people who were there, and we just happened to have a bloody good group of people. The thing again that went down with it is that we were signed on for 18 months, and while we were out there, they put an extra 6 months, and that did knock us sideways. But then I started realising that we were good in what we were doing. So we took a pride in what we were doing. And other regiments said that the Suffolks are doing all right, and we had the best record. We'd lost less men because of our indulgence, our way of patrolling, our weaponry training, and also the fact that I think, again, back to the officers and NCOs. And we didn't want to go with anybody else, because I had the opportunity of going with somebody else. But then anybody who showed any signs of being army orientated, they asked them if they wanted to sign on. And they asked me if I wanted to sign on. And they said, straight away, you'd become a sergeant. I was a corporal by then, section leader. Because when I looked at it, I was the only one who could read a map. Again, my scouts thing, my senior scout days, I read the map. The map, what we could see, is like a blank bit of paper with a tributary going up and the height of a mountain. That's all it gave you. But I could take a compass bearing, I could relay a compass bearing, a reading to it. And one time, we had an officer, he's dead now, so it doesn't make much difference. He was called the Right Honourable Ponsonby. Two things, he was a little bit erratic, and he had a very bad stutter. And he became, eventually came Lord Ponsonby, and he was in charge of the House of Lords. Well, I went up to see him, but he wasn't there on the day. But my wife was frightened to death that I was going to meet him. Anyway, what happened on his patrol, we were going around in circles, large circles, 2 or 3 mile circle, and the tracker, we used to have Borneo trackers and Malaysian trackers, Dayaks, Ebans, and they were very good. They lived in the jungles in their own country. And I got on very well with several of them and learnt to speak their language a little bit. And one of the trackers pointed down and said, "We are passed this way." What he was saying, that we're going around in circles and we're going over the same area, because we've hit a track here, someone's cut this recently. "Oh, here we go, be alert, chap, be alert." And the tracker said it was us. He could tell the way they cut, that was us. So I stopped, and there was a sergeant with us as well. So when we had a next stop, I said to the officer, "You know, we're going around in circles. Don't be silly." I said, "We're going around in circles." "Who told you that?" I said, "Well, the tracker here, what does he know about it?" I said, come on. I said, "He's paid to be, he's our tracker. He lives in there." So he said, "No, we'll go this way." I said, "Well, if you're going that way," I said, "you're going further in. The idea is that it's 3 o'clock, we're going out, aren't we? We've got a radio when we get to the edge of the jungle to get the trucks in." And he wanted to go a different way, so I said, "Well, you go that way, we're going this way." He said, "You know, that is mutiny." And the sergeant didn't say a thing. We found out he was an alcoholic, so we didn't know them. So I took charge of the patrol, and the rest of the bloke said, "Well, we're following Birdie. We're going out with you." So he had to trudgingly hang on the back of us. I said to the Eban, or the tracker, "Which way out, Jacko?" That way. So I went out, and we were 2 miles up from where we should have hit the road. And so when I got back to base camp, we had a CO, a bloke called Major Fields. We used to call him Lucy Fields. He looked a terrible person, but he very aggressive eyes and stern face. But he was a man. He was a gentleman. And I was marched into the office on the base. I was still in my jungle kit, still in my filth. And he was shouting at me, and he was motioning me to sit down. He was still shouting at me, and he opened his cigarette box. Cigarette. Still shouting at me. Lit up, I thought, what's going off here? So the QSO, or the warrant officer, went out the door, and he said, "I'm sorry, but Dad," he said, "I've got to shout at you." He said, "Because Lieutenant Ponsonby is next door, and he's listening to the inquiry and my verdict and so forth. This must not happen again, Burdett." "Is that a cigarette? Would you like another cigarette later on?" "Must not happen again. I can't emphasise this situation. We cannot have mutiny. What have you got to say for yourself?" "That's all very well, you're going around in circles," he said, "but he said, you could advise." I said, "I did advise him, but he ignored it." "Well, it's not, now, I can't have your word, it won't happen again." "It will not happen again, sir." "Very well, then take some more cigarettes if you want to." And Ponsonby came, as if, you know, "I told you so." The next time we went out on patrol, Ponsonby was with us again. And then he went from our company, every company had it, because he was bloody useless. And we met there must have been 7 or 8 bandits, communists. And they were to our right. We all heard him at the same time, but he thought he'd have to give a command. And of course, with his stutter, he was going... And he wasn't pointing his weapon at me, he was pointing his walking stick at me. See? So we all let fly. He said, "That's right, he fire." We got half of them, because they heard him going... Oh, dear. His son is actually taking over the Lords now. I think he'll look after the security and the catering and so forth like that. He walks around like Black Rod with the old black silk things with a rosette on his scarf, you know, and his all the shirts all fluffy all around his. Because we went round the Parliament House, right, Westminster, and one of the chaps was in the Royal Marines, and he got 20 military men here. So I stepped out and I said, "Yes." He said, "What mob are you asking for, Suffolk?" "Oh, I'll shake your hand," he said. "Shake your hand." Because he was out there 2 or 3 years afterwards. And the training procedure, the jungle training procedure, was the Suffolks did it this way. This is in the manual, and it's in the American manual. The Suffolks media ambush and their ambush procedure and their patrol procedure. So when you're watching the Americans and the British forces now, we didn't create it, but we emphasised it. We made it successful on this way of patrolling. And of course, have you watched the Irish, the IRA encounter where the British blokes are walking through Belfast and so forth, and you'll all see the rear soldier turn and walk backwards, just two or three steps, and walk, look around like that, and then go back to his procedure.
Who was instrumental in developing that with you while you were out there? Was it?
I think it was the old Chindit boys. They found out, you know, that the Japs used to... And it's a natural thing if you look at it, you think about it. You can hear them, you can't... If you can get a glimpse of them, but you won't be able to... If you keep on a straight line, and you're cutting your way through, you can see probably 50 yards back. Now, they don't know how close they are to you. They can hear you, but they can't see you. So they're making progress quicker than you are, because you're cutting your way. They're not. So they gain on you. So you just got to see them and then get the blokes to drop. Spread out like a V formation, and so you don't fire in front of the bloke in front of you.
Another issue there is obviously the amount of responsibility that was put upon the sergeants and corporals within out in Malaya.
Yeah.
I mean, was this one of the first kind of corporals' war? Because would you sound there very much like in that incident you talked with the officer Ponsonby,
yeah,
that you were taking a very active role in how that patrol should have been going on. You were saying, no, you're wrong there. So how much responsibility did you take on when you became a corporal?
It may have been the fact of the rank, being a corporal and a sergeant, but you can get a quiet sergeant, you can get a quiet corporal. I think it's because I was rather outspoken. My father has always taught me, as I said to you before, never volunteer. I'll go into that when I did volunteer for some of things anyway. But, and also, call them sir if they are entitled to be called sir. Give anybody respect that you respect. They've got to earn that respect. So I felt equal, and I wasn't downtrodden. I never have been when I've been to an interview. Nobody's overpowered me at all. And so in the army, and they thought I was a natural. Well, I was a natural. No matter, it's not the army, it's anything. In my cycling days, I took charge of the team. I think you have leaders, you have big mouths or big heads or something like that, but someone's got to take charge, and somebody I can administrate. I've run garages, my own garages, and I administrated. I'm not a mechanic. I know the basic fundamentals of the things, but rudiments of the thing, but I can administrate to other people. So I did that. I took it on my head to say, well, bugger this, we're going around in circles, this is getting us nowhere. But I don't think the sergeant was aware of it, because it was his probably alcoholic situation the night before.
So, yeah. But with that, was there a lot of responsibility then placed on corporals?
You took it by opening your mouth, you took the responsibility. It was self-preservation.
So this, if we take it slightly back to this sort of first period, I mean, it was the sort of, was it the July 1950 to November 1950?
Yeah, that's right.
Where you're in Johor.
Yeah.
How many kind of contacts did you have in that period?
Not many. That was unusual. We didn't have a lot of contacts. There was a rumour going round, and it's only a rumour, that a friend of mine, who lives not far away, a quarter of a mile away from here, was a radio operator. And he got a message in for the HQ. It came from a rubber company. And it had been relayed to several people. And what it was is the fact that we are to leave a certain area alone because arrangements have been made. Now, we think, we're putting two and two together and getting 16 here, but we think that the rubber companies were paying the bandits to keep away from their area.
Was this peculiar to the kind of Johor area, or was it...
Yes, because I think it stopped afterwards, because they hadn't got the confidence in the British Army at that time. Here they go again, you know, they're going to show the flag and expect everybody to bend their knees and doff their hats because the British are here, but they didn't realise that we were going to be successful. So they were playing two games there.
And were the bandits particularly active in the Johor area?
Yeah, yeah.
Was it one of the most active areas?
The most active areas were around Kuala Lumpur. That was the most active. They were, because they could go into the town and cities, you see, like that, and take their uniforms off and put the civvies on. That's the worst part about it. You didn't know who you were passing when you went in the villages. They went past you on their bikes, all dressed up and so forth, and they had the kit in the basket.
So it was in that period, then, that you had relatively few contacts in that first period, did you?
Relatively few, yeah. Well, say one in 50 throughout. There would be one in 100 down in Johor.
Because was there a point, I think by November 1950, you did extensive jungle training in Penang. What did that, did that involve?
Well, that was more like a rest period. It wasn't jungle training. They were quite happy with us there. But they wanted to get us more like an army. Marching, parades, and weapon training, cleaning. And I think they introduced the Owen gun to us there. Because that was a recent gun, a weapon that they applied. And that kind of thing. They wanted to, it gave us a fillet to our physical endurance, because we were getting knackered. We were overextended and we were working bloody hard. Out nearly every night, marching, and we were on patrol. Saturdays and Sundays, we didn't have any different day.
So that extensive period when you'd kind of done those, what, nearly 6 months of jungle patrolling in Johor, they then gave you, what was it, a month or so?
Yeah, a month, yeah.
And that was just, if I've got this right, that's just really to keep you up to physical fitness, but not be doing the normal...
No, we weren't doing patrolling. Routine. No, yeah. No. It was a recreation period, but with military connotations, that they had to smarten us up. I mean, we used to go walking into the headquarters, and there we were, covered in this red ochre or crap, and just slouch in. We didn't march into the... They used to try and get us to march in. We thought, bugger that. We haven't got any energy to do. We're doing a job here. We're not here to do guard duties. All right? We're doing different things. We're here to maintain peace and, well, tranquility in the country. We did do that.
What were you wearing when you did? We were doing these jungle patrols. What was the kit that you had with you?
It was mostly American design. It was more like an open weave material. It was a bush jacket, trousers. It gave us loads and loads of cellular underpants and singlets. One thing about Malaya, you could wash ever so quickly when the camp, and you'd put your stuff out on the side of the marquee or the bashi you were in, and within an hour it would dry. So you could wash, and you really had adobe facilities as well, washing facilities, and that was quite good. We had our special BDs, olive green they were. We had, did away with all our webbing for Blanco, and it was all green webbing. Pouches were different. We didn't use straps on our shoulders. We put the pouches actually on our belts so they could hold their hand grenades or extra weapons or extra rounds and so forth. Bandolier of 50 rounds. In the early days in Johor, we had to account for every round we shot, fired. And a hand grenade, you had to justify it. Why were you doing this? Why were you doing that? Later on, they just found out it was stupid. You were there to do it, and so they knew that rounds would go amiss. If you fired 25 rounds at one bloke and missed him, why did you do that? So we did go on the firing range every so often to get our accuracy, because mostly we used to blaze away with rough alignment, they call it, from the hip, even with a rifle. And that is not so accurate as going from the shoulder.
When you're wearing this kit in the jungle, is it uncomfortable to wear in, obviously, patrolling? Does it chafe or...?
The belt used to chafe round your hips. Because, as I say, we were probably 10 stone, nothing. And you couldn't have the belt tight, so it gradually, with the weight of the hand grenades, the water bottle and your ammunition, it would pull down one side where the weight was, so it and it would chafe your hip. And gradually, you got hard skin there. Just by doing that. Oh, everybody had a red mark around the rib, around the centre. And you sweat as soon as you get off your lorries. As soon as the wind stopped on the lorries, you just start getting hot. And when you went into the jungle, you just sweated with the jungle. It poured off you. And we used to have these little white handkerchiefs, little towels round. Some of them had green, but we had white, which is stupid. In the early days, we used to even have our badge on our hat and our stripes. And then we thought, hang on, this, we're asking for trouble, because we wondered why they were trying to hit the corporals, the NCOs and the officers. The officers even did away with their map box. They put the maps in their pockets with a cloth. So we got away with all badges, and we knew the corporals, so what's the point? You don't have to tell the bandits that they're corporals. We knew they were there. So all recognition went out. Because one time you looked around the valley and you could see something shining. And it was one of our blokes, our patrols, walking towards us, and the son had got his cap badge. So we stood away with that.